This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
You bitch! No idea how bad it gets.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy?
Don't stomp your little lassies and Prada she's a need, honey.
John Callier, will you go around with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a curve?
I had a hunch he might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is broke right now.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening, in honour of its 20th anniversary, we are celebrating James Cameron's iconic tour de force, Titanic, which was first released on December 19, 1997. 20 years ago, Alan.
Almost to the day.
Almost.
And you know, there are some other momentous things occurring in 1997. And can you think of any, Daniel?
Madonna won the Golden Globe for her turn as Evita in Evita.
Oh, my God, yes. And Ellen DeGeneres came out. Now, that was a life-changing moment.
And, of course, the Spice Girls were at the top of their game.
Have we got any Spice Girls playing?
We don't. No? Sorry, not really? Allowed. No, No. We are an honourable film review program.
Hey, hang on. Don't they sing about being, what's their song about being king, you know, ruling the world? What's that?
I don't know.
This would come in really handy for this episode.
Okay.
You know, for the Titanic, you know, I'm king of the world. You know, sadly, Princess Diana died that year.
It was a big year.
And so too did Gianni Versace.
No doubt, a big year, fittingly, a really big film. I mean, this film was a critical and commercial success. Mm. A lot of people expected it to fail. At the time, no film had been made for quite so much money. We're talking about a $200 million budget.
Or went for quite so long. I mean, it was a three-hour film.
Well, films did go for more than 3 hours, but yes, but 3 hours is 3 hours and 15 minutes is pushing it.
CC Daniel, I don't know about you, but in 1997 I was adult and I actually quite remember what films were like at that time, and a 3 hour film did not come to the cinemas very often, I can tell you that.
Yes, well, I was 9 years old, so. But I mean, this film broke all records, or at least it tied the records. I mean, it tied with All About Eve for the most Academy Award nominations ever, 14. It won 11, tying with Ben-Hur, and later with The Return of the King.
The Return of the King? Oh, as in Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yes. Peter Jackson.
Winning 11, I mean, so it's one of three films to have won 11 Academy Awards. It holds that record too. Yeah. At the time, it took out the record for the highest grossing film of all time, grossing worldwide $1.84 billion.
So, Daniel, Titanic by name and Titanic by nature.
Exactly.
I mean, what a huge film.
And it's gone on to gross more because, of course, they re-released it in 2012 to mark the ship's 100-year anniversary of its sinking.
Yeah.
Mm. And it made a further $343 million.
Oh, my God, it's the gift that keeps on
giving. And they're re-releasing it now in the US.
Oh, yeah. And the spin that James Cameron is giving this new release, saying it's like it's a brand new film, digitally remastered, and it's like it's amazing. But is he hoping to gain another $300 million?
Well, he might do it. There is no doubt that this was a groundbreaking film.
And the Oscar goes to Titanic.
Now, you're breaking out in goosebumps, aren't you, Alan?
How did you guess? I'm literally breaking out in goosebumps.
I mean, this is going to be the most amazing hour. I'm so excited that we get to spotlight this one iconic, groundbreaking tour de force for the next hour. It's going to be so much fun.
It is going to be so much fun. And you know what? We want to hear from you, the listener. We want to hear what you think about Titanic. And we want to hear what your favorite moments are from the film, your favorite scenes. Text in and let us know your thoughts.
We'll be counting down our favorite moments later in the program, but message in and let us know yours. The number is 0427JOY949.
Or you can email us on air at joy.org.au.
But Alan, I also want to have a chat about why it is that this film broke so many records. I mean, a lot of people said it was destined to be a failure. A lot of people said it wouldn't work. And James Cameron, while he has since surpassed the record that he set with Titanic with Avatar, which grossed, I think, over $2 billion globally, he had made some solid films, but certainly none of this kind of magnitude.
No, definitely not. And, you know, my response to that is haters are going to hate. And, you know, sadly, we don't have a Taylor Swift song coming up, but I think the thing here is potentially that time. I think CGI was still really just beginning to find its feet within the film industry, and there was a lot of talk at that time that this film was going to have a lot of CGI, and I wonder if that sort of had some impact as to the naysayers really of why they thought this film may not.
But the film was groundbreaking in so many ways. Yes, it introduced new kind of technologies, which now when you watch the film do feel a little bit outdated.
They do,
especially the iceberg. It does feel outdated. However, there were all kinds of new methods to filmmaking that James Cameron introduced with this film. So, for example, in that obviously the famous sinking scene, which is not so much a scene as a movie unto itself, an hour and a half of the ship sinking.
I know, the whole second half of the film is devoted to the sinking of the ship. Yeah.
They enclosed a 5 million US gallon tank to kind of house the shipping exterior and kind of plunged the sets into this 5 million US gallon tank. So that scene, for instance, with the staircase, that very iconic staircase, when that sinks and the water kind of crashes in through the glass ceiling.
Yep. So this is the staircase with the big clock.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which is revisited in that final montage where the clock is actually set at the precise time that the ship sank.
Oh, you were paying attention, weren't you? I think I missed that detail.
A 5 million US gallon tank. I mean, that is, and that's why Kate Winslet caught hypothermia when she was filming this film, because in that much water, you can't really control the temperature, can you?
You know what, Daniel? I was struck when watching this film when you know, Kate's getting into the water. I mean, Kate's the only, I think there, we've got two moments in the entire film where people get into the water and only twice do we hear, oh, that's cold. When in actual fact, we're up in the Arctic, it would have been bloody freezing.
Busy dying, to be fair.
Jeez, I mean, that would have been, you would have seen the shock on their faces.
So yes, I mean, some people attribute the film's success to its groundbreaking filming methods. Mm-hmm. James Cameron, when he won the Oscar, and we heard Sean Connery announcing that the film had won the Oscar just a few moments ago, James Cameron had this to say.
In the midst of all this euphoria, it's kind of hard for us to remember that this euphoria and the success is for a film that's based on a real event that happened. So I'd just like everybody to go with me just for a second on something here. I'd like to do a few seconds of silence in remembrance of the 1,500 men, women, and children who died when the great ship died. And the message of Titanic, of course, is that if the great ship can sink, the unthinkable can happen. The future's unknowable. The only thing that we truly own is today. Life is precious, so during these few seconds, I'd like you to also listen to the beating of your own heart, which is the most precious thing in the world.
And the full hall then went on to observe a few moments' silence. But the point that Cameron is making here, and I think it's a really important point, is that this is a film about seizing the moment. Mm. And I have a feeling that that's why it's resonated so much, amongst other factors. It's unique blend of historical drama with kind of romance, which I don't think we've seen on such big scale since like Gone with the Wind. You know, it's of that kind of magnitude. Yeah. Obviously, that's another reason why it's resonated, but I do think there's something to be said for that message in this film, the kind of seize the day ethos of the production.
You know what, Daniel? I think that's a really succinct feeling to take from the film. I'm not sure if I took that, but I totally
get it. Well, what did you take
it.
From the
I
film,
I totally
Alan?
Get it, but no, we're actually asking why we think that it sort of had such broad appeal. Because, you know what, I think it sort of appealed to so many different audiences. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why it was so popular. I mean, it appealed to the romantic audience because there's such a strong romance, and I think really, ultimately, that's what we all take from the film is the romance. But at the same time, too, I mean, there's the incredible action scenes, the technology, the special effects. So, you know, great for people who love action films. And, of course, there's that whole element around special effects, which are great for the nerds. So, I mean, it's had such broad appeal.
And also, you know, when I was 9 when this film came out, I remember being captivated by the mythology around Titanic itself.
Absolutely.
This sinking ship and, you know, how this could happen. It's one of those things where you just – because by today's standard, you know, this kind of tragedy, we have laws now to prevent this kind of tragedy from happening, you know, with lifeboats and such. So, I think there's a whole, it kind of taps into this mythology of times gone and this kind of terrible, terrible tragedy that just makes it kind of irresistible.
It is irresistible. And I think also at that time, I think, you know, the publicity machine and the hype, around the Titanic itself and how it was being built and how the owners of the Titanic line were able to manipulate the public opinion around its impregnability and its unsinkability, if that's such a word.
And I think the film certainly taps into that. The other reason I think this is a hugely successful film...
Tell me. What next?
Are you making fun of me, Alan?
No.
You would never.
You've got a list. We've got to make our way through.
This is not a list.
Okay, come to
I think that the other reason it's successful is because it's so well written. Now, bear with me on this because it's like, I hear what you're saying, Daniel. This is a very poorly written film.
Could you hear my eye roll?
Could
you hear that eye roll?
I could see it too.
Okay.
Like it taps into every kind of cliche. There's like when you break it down, there's really nothing novel about this story.
No.
But cinema goers love by the book storytelling. They do because there's this sense of comfort, this sense that we know what's happening, even though we don't really, but there's a sense of familiarity that I think this film really taps into. And James Cameron was able to weave so many cliches, even with certain phrases that have since become iconic, and we're going to explore those later. But I really do feel like he gave us a story that was so easy to follow, but yet so engaging because it was so by the books, but had these kind of mythological.
So true. It was almost operatic in a way. I mean,
it's a melodrama.
Maybe it's almost, like a soap opera in a way. Melodramatic. I mean, like it's a tragic opera. You know, in a sense, I mean, we've got this grand epic story, with a tragedy at the end. I mean, what's not to love about that?
And, you know, there were studies done on this film's effect on men in particular.
Oh, right.
On because so many men were crying during the film, and it actually augmented this whole kind of avenue of study into male habits when they go and watch films. It's really quite remarkable. But again, gender is something that we're going to look at later in the program because the film has a lot to say about gender.
Oh, it does indeed.
So we'll be doing our gender specific queer reading of this film later in the program, but more on this remarkable groundbreaking film coming up on Outtakes right after this.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening, in honour of its 20th anniversary this week, we are celebrating James Cameron's iconic tour de force, Titanic.
And we've had a message in, Daniel, from our co-host Gina, lovely Gina who can't make it today. Gina says one of the things that she's liked most about the film is the idea of Daniel, age 9, crying into his popcorn. But apart from that, Gina's favourite part is the adorable best line of the Titanic is, draw me like one of your French girls, Kate. And Gina says Kate Winslet draws her in every time. Well, I'm not surprised, Gina, that's probably one of your favourite lines.
Love me some Kate. So, Gina, if you're listening, this is for you.
Jack, I want you to draw me like one of your French girls, wearing this. Wearing only this.
And that is just one of... I was talking before about some of the cheesy lines. You know, there was an interview with Stephen Colbert and Kate Winslet that went to air just a few days ago. Yeah. And he says to her, did you not break down laughing when you said that line, draw me like one of your French girls? And she's like, no, I didn't. But it's one of so many classic lines in this film, like this line.
Makes me laugh every time.
Or this one.
It's been 84 years.
I love that one. That's me at the end of every university class. No, if you like Gina, have a favorite moment in this film, message in. Let us know what your favorite moment is. The number is 0427JOY949, or you can email us at onair@joy.org.au. And you know, Alan, we want to know what our listeners think of the casting in this film as well, because I think, you know, if we're talking about reasons why the film has resonated so much, I think the casting in this film was spot on, and it could have been so wrong. So we have Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio in the two leading roles. Mm-hmm. And before they were cast, the studio was eyeing, well, in the case of Leonardo DiCaprio, it was eyeing Matthew McConaughey.
Really?
Tom Cruise?
No.
And in the role of Rose DeWitt-Decatur, it was eyeing Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, I could see Gwyneth.
I could see Gwyneth too, actually. Yeah, definitely. That's a fair call. But Tom Cruise?
Tom Cruise. Oh, no.
And do you know who they were eyeing in...
I'm sorry, I just have to clear my throat. There's a little bit of vomit. Okay.
Do you know who they were eyeing in the role of the unsinkable Molly Brown, played to perfection by Kathy Bates?
Oh, Kathy was amazing. But tell me.
Have a guess.
You've got me. Meryl Streep?
No, that, I mean, I'm
Helen
not,
Mirren?
I'm not going to crap all over the idea of Meryl Streep in that role.
Of course not. I knew I had you.
Talking about recasting. I would recast Meryl in the role of Jack. I would recast Meryl in the role of Rose.
Oh, jeez. I could see it now. This is a special edition of Titanic. Meryl Streep in multiple roles. Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah. I can't wait to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Cate Blanchett would be playing all of the supporting roles. Madonna.
Madonna as
the studio tapped originally Madonna to play the unsinkable Molly Brown, and she was of course all tied up with Evita, which she went on to win the Golden Globe for. But
I just cannot see that, Daniel. I cannot.
So, but you can see how this could have so easily been a train wreck.
Oh, but hey, I've got to say one thing. I know that Leonardo DiCaprio at that time was at the height, absolute height of his popularity as a teen heartthrob, or a young, you know, heartthrob for young women and boys.
He was a boy himself.
Yes, he was. I mean, like, he was 20 years old. He was 20 years old at the time.
He looks 12.
But he looked so young. And at times I kind of think, how does this young, boyish-looking person actually get himself to Paris and have this amazing experience in Paris drawing
French girls?
Drawing French girls.
That's how he does it.
And then gets himself onto the Titanic. It just didn't, you know, it just didn't ring true from that sense. But having said that, Leonardo was perfect for the role, and he brought this amazing ethereal elfin beauty to
the role. I can almost guarantee that were they making the film now, they would cast Zac Efron in his role. I would boycott the film.
Go away.
I would boycott?
No.
But I can almost guarantee it.
Oh, well, listen, I've got my thoughts.
Okay.
Shall I tell you who?
Yeah, tell
can
us.
Can I tell you who I think?
Yeah, go for it.
Who I think should play Jack if it was recast today would be Eddie Redmayne. For sure.
He's too old. No. He's in his early 30s.
Yeah, but Eddie can pull off a younger look, and he's done it before. I reckon he would do
no,
really well.
Okay, no, right, no, what's no. Your pick? For Jack?
For Jack, yeah.
I struggle with Jack. Okay. Maybe Liam Hemsworth?
Oh, come on.
Can you see it?
Liam Hemsworth.
And you know who I would cast in the role of Rose?
Yeah.
Saoirse Ronan. I've butchered her name, but from Brooklyn.
Yes. Yeah, perfect. Actually, yeah, perfect. Better than my choices, I have
Who
to
was
say.
Your...
My Rose was going to be Jennifer Lawrence or Margot Robbie.
Oh, my God, they're both in everything. Can we please have somebody else? Well, we have had a message in from another listener who suggests, just for you, Alan, Nicole Kidman in the role of... Clearly somebody is familiar with your taste in actress.
Actually, you know what? If Nicole Kidman laid off on the Botox, she could play Rose's mother in this film.
I would have Cate Blanchett in that role.
Okay. Oh.
I would have Cate Blanchett in that role. In the role of unsinkable Molly Brown.
Hang on. I've got to tell you who I think the mother should be.
Okay.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally see it.
Yeah, boom, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, look, I scored.
And Meryl Streep in the role of the unsinkable Molly Brown.
I knew you were going to say Meryl Streep. But you know what? I'm going for Melissa McCarthy.
Oh, I can see it.
Yes.
That's so, some creative casting.
Yeah, that is creative casting, yeah. You know, a bit of comedy that comes to that and her larger-than-life persona that would come through. Yes.
Look, the film wouldn't be as huge a success, but...
As it would be with Meryl Streep, of course, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, right. But I think, like, we joke and jest, and we do want to hear what you think. We want to hear who you think would play these iconic roles if the film was being remade today, because let's face it, Hollywood remakes every other film. But
I'm really keen to hear what our listeners have to say about this. This is fascinating.
I am too, but I mean, we do have to dwell for a moment on the remarkable chemistry that Cate and Leo, I mean, Cate and Leo, you know, that's what they're called.
Mm.
That's their names.
That's
their name. But no, like they are an item, you know, they are an item. And
to this day, I mean, they still have that chemistry in film, and they often talk about collaborating because of this unique chemistry and friendship that they have.
Right. So, and that chemistry is, you know, it's everything in this film, especially that scene. You know the scene I'm talking about where she comes back to him, where she kind of goes through this.
Yeah, tell me.
You're looking at me with blank eyes.
There's so many times in the film when she comes back to him. So which one are we referring to?
All right, let's play the clip.
Play the clip.
Changed my mind. They said you might be up to it.
Give me your hand. Now close your eyes. Go on. Now step up. Onto the railing. Keep your eyes closed. Don't peek.
I'm not.
Step up onto the rail. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes closed. Do you trust me?
I trust you.
Oh, Daniel, what a great scene. I think we're all flying with Cate in that. I think that's when we really got swept away in the love affair, for me anyway.
And in the magic of it.
Yeah.
And like, this is a moment, this is a cinematic moment where all of the cinematic production elements just line up so perfectly. We have this remarkable score that James Horner, since deceased, unfortunately, has written and composed with these remarkable visual effects, the sky and all of these kind of autumnal hues, and then the costuming and her kind of billowy dress, kind of billowing in the wind, and then, of course, these very cliched, corny, cheesy lines that are just everything when they're up there on the screen.
Yes.
And the chemistry.
Yeah. And I think you've hit it in one when you talk about the score in this instance. I mean, that there, what really comes through there is the atmosphere, the ambiance that's really coming through from the music. That's what's, you know, really driving that emotional connection to this particular scene.
Now, if we're going to talk about the music, we can't, I mean, the score is groundbreaking, earth shattering. It broke all kind of records in terms of the sales of the score, surpassed any other score ever written for a film.
Hey, I have a confession to make. I actually bought the CD.
So did I. It was my first ever CD.
Oh my God, really, Daniel? Yeah. That is,
it's really embarrassing, isn't it?
You've not mentioned that before.
It was the first CD. I got it. I was in year five at the time.
Yep.
Never bought a CD before. Was crushed when I found out there was only one song on it and the rest of it was music.
Let me guess, you had Celine on repeat.
Oh my God.
You play her on repeat for an hour at a time.
Of course I did. Can we talk?
You know what? You weren't the only one.
Yeah. Why am I not surprised, Alan? Can we talk about that song for a moment? Because originally James Cameron did not want any vocals.
Oh, wow. That's
across the film at all. Mm. He just wanted music in that credit scene. And James Horner kind of penned the script behind his back. I forget the name of the songwriter.
Oh, sorry, I don't have that. I didn't do the research on that one, Daniel. But very accomplished songwriter this person was, no doubt, because it delivered such a fantastic...
Well, if you know the name of the songwriter, I was under the impression all of these years that it was Dolly Parton. I think because the lyrics were as basic as I Will Always Love You. Like, let's be honest, you're here, there's nothing I fear. They're not very creative lyrics, are they? But it wasn't. It wasn't. No. I don't know why I thought that. And the name escapes me now. So message in if you know who wrote this song. But there is no doubt that the song, like the film, like the soundtrack, broke all records. It won, I think, a number of Grammy Awards. It won the Academy Award for the best song. And Celine didn't want to do it originally.
Well, you know what? At least we can, you know, I think the thing here is that even though she decided that she didn't want to do it to begin with, she woke up to her senses. So, you know, she snapped out of it and she decided
to do it. Well, what happened was...
I couldn't imagine anybody else actually singing that song. And I wonder, I remember at the time, because this song was so popular, that this was obviously an element of its success as well, that driving people to the cinema. People heard the song as well as hearing the hype and boom, they're in.
Well, here's Celine talking about the song.
Every night it's all the breathy. You're here, there's nothing I fear. And I know it's all breathy. And then you're here, there's nothing I fear. And I know that my heart, you have to be like killing it. So it's like from soft to hard. Ooh, 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 ooh. So it's hard.
You know, making a lot of sense there.
Totally. When she, you know, just that little snippet there, you can just tell just the artistry that's gone into, you know, singing that song. But Daniel, Celine wasn't the only person to have sung that song on stage, was she, Daniel?
If this is going to be a Britney Spears reference.
No. I thought, didn't you yourself sing this song?
Once? We're not going there, Alan.
No, okay. I only wish we had a clip of that experience. Did someone do the audio of that performance?
Might have been my About a Boy moment.
Yes.
Okay. But look, Celine has sung some really iconic soundtracks in her time, like this. When you do you recognize this? You do, don't you?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't. I don't. Was it a Disney?
No, you were close. Stuart Little. Do you remember Stuart Little, the film about the mouse?
Yeah, I do. I don't remember that.
That was the soundtrack for that film, or there was, of course, this very famous soundtrack.
Played at every good wedding, everywhere, at many places. But no, I don't know the film.
You don't know the film.
Oh my God, I'm
Michelle Pfeiffer. There's your hint.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Up Close and Personal was the film.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then, of course, I think one of my favourites. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Now, Alan, you're breaking out in fits of laughter, and I suspect that's because it's three strikes.
You and you're out. Oh, my God, you read my mind. I was definitely
You've got
three,
no idea,
three
do
strikes
you?
And you're out. I'm such a bad guy.
Bicentennial Man with Robin Williams.
Oh, right.
Did you ever see that?
I did see it.
A really touching film.
I enjoyed the film, but that song was a bit forgettable. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God, no, I love that song. But I have to say, My Heart Will Go On does have a special place in my heart.
Oh, me too, Daniel. Without a doubt, it's been a song on high rotation within my life and will continue to do so.
Shall we?
It's one of my favorites.
Shall we play the
Can
song,
Can we belt
Alan?
It out? Can we belt it out together?
I think let Celine do the belting. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9. You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema. If you can't tell from that song, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9. That was, of course, Celine Dion with My Heart Will Go On, which we're playing tonight in celebration of the 20th, can you believe it, 20th anniversary of Titanic, which was first released on December 19, 1997, 20 years ago. That's the US release date. 20 years goes quick.
I know, half a lifetime. It's gone in a blink.
So we are celebrating the film, and we're turning our attention now to something that I think the film deals with really effectively, which is gender relations. And to help us with that, we have Tess in the studio.
Hi.
Tess from 21st Century Women, which has just won an award.
Best newcomer. I know.
Congratulations.
Oh my God. Well, I've been on the show for 3 weeks. It's all about me. It's entirely my doing. No. Yeah, it's really exciting. Like, the girls have been doing such an amazing job this year. And it's such a fun show to have joined just recently. And yeah, we're having a blast. So
and there are all
stoked.
Kinds of perks, like getting to come on Outtakes.
I know. Yeah. Look at this.
That is like the pinnacle of success.
Mm-hmm. I know. I was like, I want to go guest anchor on a show on Joy so that I can get on this other show on Joy.
Totally makes sense. Totally makes sense.
Realize that life goal.
Ladder climber, guys.
Now, I think the film does a lot of really interesting things in relation to gender. Obviously, Titanic went down in history for this kind of women and children.
It did go down. It went completely so. I had to.
No pun intended.
Well, this men and women and children first idea, and that's one idea which the film kind of looks at. In its
Daniel, sorry, I have to sort of clarify that a little bit. It was actually first class passengers, men and women and children first.
Right. Now that's called that's intersectionality for you, isn't
there
it?
There you go. Boom.
But you know, they actually did a study just recently, and they studied 18 different maritime disasters from between the years of 1850 and 2011.
That sounds like a fun time, doesn't it?
Yeah, that sounds like great research.
We had a good slideshow on that one.
Their aim was to test whether reports of chivalrous self-sacrifice during the sinking of Titanic were exceptional. And what they found was that there were only two instances of the 18 that they studied where women and children were actually put first, where they were actually given the first seats in the lifeboat. So it's a kind of myth that this was established practice.
Mm. Yeah.
And we wondered how you, with your 21st century woman feminist lens, would read this kind of decision to put women and children first.
Was it the first time they've done it? The Titanic was the first time that's documented.
This was the second time that it happened.
It's an interesting view of how women are valued, I guess, because you sort of think why what would be this decision of women and children first? Is it like a manners thing of, like, you know, ladies opening a door for a lady, or is it maybe perhaps that women can bear children and therefore get them in the boat because we need more babies. Maybe I feel like there's,
or is,
like,
it because
where does it
the
come
men are
from?
Men are strong, they're survivors,
so they can swim through the because yeah, I mean, like, that's, I think that's, or is it because they are the weaker sex? So it'd be interesting to know what the logic behind it was.
Well, I think the film itself kind of informs what it sees as the logic behind that decision, and it does that through the relationship, I think, of Cal and Rose. And there's this wonderful scene after Rose is found out to have been dancing with Jack, where Cal kind of confronts her in this really kind of brutish way.
I see you had that undertaker of a manservant follow me. How typical.
You will never behave like that again, Rose. Do you understand?
I'm not a foreman in one of your mills that you can command. I'm your fiancé.
I feel. Yes, you are. My wife in practice, if not yet by law, so you will honor me. You will honor me the way a wife is required to honor a husband. Because I will not be made out of fool, Rose. Is this in any way unclear?
No.
Good. Excuse me.
It's a really remarkable scene, I think, but I do think it kind of captures the way that gender relations were structured at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. Women were property. Women weren't allowed to own property. Like the grand aspiration of a woman in those days, I guess sort of regardless of class, actually, was to find a husband and to settle down. If you were the, if you didn't, you were a spinster who was left behind. So,
well, that's what Frances Fisher, who plays Rose's mother, says when she's chatting with her very upper class friends. She says, "Well, Rose already has a fiancé. What does she need university for? Surely the only point of university is to find a man."
Absolutely right. If, that's what she said. She said,
"You know what, Alan? I have been at university for 10 years and still haven't found a man." That must be why I'm still at university.
They gotta be somewhere. They gotta be somewhere.
And the other really interesting thing I think about the way that gender is cast in this film is the wonderful contrast that we have between this very, I'm going to say it, effeminate masculinity that Jack embodies. He is the artiste true and proper. Mm-hmm. He has, let's face it, a very gay haircut. And
a very androgynous look.
And then we have Cal, who is this kind of very Byronic kind of brooding masculinity in,
angry and aggressive and hard, and as opposed to the artistic and soft and wild, free Jack. Mm.
And yet, Jack is the one who dies. So is the film punishing a certain type of masculinity?
Yeah. Is it a way that that masculinity is not allowed to survive, you know, through the, like, is it
must kill itself off because it's not strong like the, and let's like,
must sacrifice itself.
You know, let's not let truth get in the way of a good reading. I mean, ultimately, Cal kills himself too, so...
Does he know Cal survives?
Yes, yeah, but he then does. He puts a... As older Rose says, puts a pistol in his mouth.
I forgot about that.
During the Great Depression.
Oh, okay.
During the Great Depression, yeah. I mean, that's a very
Which means he's a coward.
That's a very interesting...
A coward.
No. That's a very interesting view, Daniel, where you say that because we've got this artistic, feminine view of masculinity that, you know, that
can't
has to
survive.
Be killed. That has to be killed off. And, you know, that thought didn't really occur to me until you've just
look, I don't pretend that this was what James Cameron had in mind when
he... It must have been.
But I do think, you know, texts lend themselves to all kinds of readings that the authors of those texts didn't really intend.
Yeah.
And I think that it is a very valid point to make that there are two kinds of masculinity here that are being explored in the film. One is, yes, cast to be very villainous, very Gaston-esque. You know, we have to bring up Disney. It's a it's a weekly thing.
Absolutely.
And for those who don't know, Beauty and the Beast is Gaston.
You know, he is reminiscent of Gaston in this way, this kind of brutish, villainous masculinity. Mm. Whereas Gaston dies in Beauty and the Beast, he survives. Doesn't get the girl, but survives in this
film. Yeah, and I mean, is punished, is shamed, is punished, and is sort of seen as the real villain. So he sort of falls from grace in that way.
Mm.
So
what do you think of Rose's journey throughout this film? At first of all, you see her cast really as the weak woman being saved on a number of occasions by a man.
And, yeah, and she goes on a real transformation, doesn't she? It's this sort of her discovering her wildness and her strength and her freedom, really. And that's what she does sort of through that relationship with Jack. But you sort of feel like it's always kind of bubbling there from the beginning. Mm. And she sort of throws off those gender norms and the gender restrictions of her age and of her gender and of her class.
Well, she does. She rebels against them, doesn't she?
Yeah. And even that idea of, you know, looking at the class element as well. And we were talking a little bit off, like when she sort of goes down into the steerage and has the big knees up sort of dance that she does with Jack, which then she gets in trouble for, you know, being wild and free and her hair, you know, comes out and they go shagging a
That's
car
it. That's
and
the
stuff,
steamy
you know.
Scene. You know,
yeah,
steamy,
with the hand and the
it's
glass.
It's the steamy windows, you know, one of the iconic scenes. But here she is, a woman of her age, actually taking control of her sexuality.
Yeah, she's got sort of sexual, what do you call it, body autonomy.
That's it.
She's taking control of her body. Yeah.
When ordinarily at that time her virginity was of
her currency.
Extreme value and currency.
Yeah, absolutely.
And here she is. She takes control and she's empowered to say, well, right, this is my body.
Yeah.
This is my sexuality and I'll live
same,
my life as
exactly
I please.
Exactly. You know, when she says, you know, draw me like one of your French girls, Jack, which I was just like, I love you, Kate Winslet. I'll draw you anytime. Yeah, it's because, you know, she's lying there and she's naked, but she's so empowered and it's so, there's nothing, you know, it's a consensual experience. She's there. She's wanting him to look. She's wanting him to draw her and she feels really empowered by that.
And it's she who initiates it as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, exactly. Like, you know, and he's the one that's sort of...
Hey, point of trivia for you. Mm. Do you know who drew that picture?
I do not, no.
Alan, do you?
No.
Have a guess.
Please enlighten me.
Have a guess.
Oh, Was it James Cameron?
It was James Cameron.
How do I know this? I've got all this weird, like, 90s trivia.
He drew that picture. Apparently she was wearing a bathing suit, Kate, when the picture was drawn. But it was James Cameron who drew that picture.
Well, I'm impressed with his X-ray vision. His powers of perception, I think,
taking
he did quite well.
Taking casting cash off. But anyway.
Very controversial.
I know, controversial post-Weinstein era. Yeah. Yep.
What's coming up on 21st Century Woman tonight?
We have got a excellent show lined up. It's Hannah, Lindsay and me on the mic. We've got Heather Bloom coming in. He's doing a show at Butterfly Club called Anti-Heroine. And, of course, your weekly feminist news, putting the fun in feminism.
Well, thank you.
We have a good time.
Thank you for joining us. 9 o'clock tonight.
9 o'clock, yep.
Every Monday night.
Every Monday.
The second best show on a Monday night.
Yeah, exactly. Best newcomer, so look out. We're after you.
More this now 20-year-old classic coming up on Outtakes right after this.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
There's something I want you to have.
Oh, it's beautiful. But wait a minute, isn't this?
Yeah, yes it is.
But I thought the old lady dropped it into the ocean in the air.
Well, baby, I went down and got it for you.
Oh, you shouldn't have. Oops.
You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9, the home of queer cinema, where this evening we are celebrating the 20th, I can't believe it, 20th anniversary of James Cameron's groundbreaking Titanic. This, of course, is Britney Spears with Oops, I Did It Again, which you literally forced me to play, Alan.
I did force you to play it because I think this exemplifies the impact that this film had on popular culture, even 3 years later. I mean, here is Britney Spears referring to this famous scene from Titanic at the end where old Rose drops, you know, that amazing diamond into the sea.
Well, you've just spoiled the film for everyone.
Oh, well, everybody
you,
knows it. I'm sorry, but that's not the end of the film. That's not the
no.
That's not the
there's
of
that
the
wonderful that yes. scene. That scene is what gets me every time.
Is that the life after the Titanic montage?
Oh. Yeah. Mm. When everyone's clapping and she just like hand first up the stairs. It's literally kind of sobbing material.
Oh my God, there's tears in your eyes.
No, there are not.
There's a tear in the studio, people. Hey, before we go on, I have to say that, hey, we got a membership.
We did get a membership.
Hamish from South Melbourne renewed his membership. So thank you very much, Hamish.
Clearly an avid Titanic fan.
Oh, without a doubt.
Look, it's been such a pleasure kind of breaking down this groundbreaking film with you, Alan. I have one question for you.
Okay, tell me, would I watch it again? Are you going to ask me that question?
No. Oh, well,
the answer to that is I will watch the first half again.
Oh, really? The second half is my favourite.
I will watch the first half up until the point where we strike the iceberg because that's an hour and a half of sinking of the ship. And then I will fast forward to the last 10 minutes.
That was like pretty much my question, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you ready to go back to Titanic?
That was the question, and you kind of answered it in your roundabout way, didn't you?
Yeah, true.
You stole my thunder.
So, like for me, the thing, what I take with me is really the story of Rose and Jack. You know, their relationship, their romance, the fact that Jack died, which I don't understand why Jack had to die. He didn't have to die.
Let me ask the question.
That's so wrong.
Let me ask the question again, Alan.
Yeah, tell me.
Are you ready to go back to Titanic?
Yes, I am. I think we have to. We have to unpick why Jack dies. I mean, that's a show in itself, Daniel.
This is the theatrical release trailer for Titanic, now 20 years old. I think we have to revisit it before the end of the program.
Arthur,
ship of dreams. And it was. It really was.
All right, open your eyes.
Got everything I need right here with me. I figure life's a gift, and I don't intend on wasting it. You never know what hand you're gonna get dealt next. You learn to take life as it comes at you.
When this ship docks, I'm getting off with you.
Daniel, I may not actually watch the film in its entirety ever again, but I will listen to that song many times.
Over and over again.
In the future, for sure.
It will go on in your heart.
It will go on and on and on.
That's it for another episode of Outtakes, Alan. It's been a real pleasure celebrating this film with you, now 20 years old.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.